This podcast is brought to you by FinPro. FinPro is a leading insurtech specialist recruitment business that operates on a global basis. We have delivered assignments across North America, throughout Europe, and into Asia. We are super excited to speak to anyone who has some recruitment challenges that is either starting or scaling a business, and we're confident we can help you find the people to help you innovate the world of insurance one new hire at a time. Please visit our website, www.wearefinpro.com, for more information. Hello and welcome to the Leadership in Insurance podcast. This is the podcast that brings you the greatest innovation changemakers in the world of insurance and insurtech. We speak to innovation leaders from carriers and brokers. We speak to insurtech founders and C-suite executives. And we bring you all of the people that add value to that community, whether it be private equity, venture capitalists, or even people like organizational psychologists and thought leaders and futurists. We try really hard to bring you the most innovative people in the world of insurance on a global basis. So with that in mind, we'd love your support. So please like, share, follow or subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Alex Bond. Welcome to the Leadership Insurance Podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the Leadership in Insurance podcast. I'm your host, Alex Bond, and I'm very lucky today to be joined by Upasana, who is the Chief Commercial Officer for Cyata. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. How are you, Alex? Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all. Thank you very much for being a guest. I think we might already run into some internet problems, so hopefully that doesn't continue, but we'll see how we get on. But thank you so much for being a guest. We were just talking. You're very politely had actually seen some of these before. So, but you're someone that we've wanted to have on for a little while, and you know, thank you for your team to sort of helping make that happen. But you know, because we've been engaged, we know a bit about the business, but we always traditionally start with if you could introduce yourself and the business that you work for, and explain a little bit about what Cyata do.
Absolutely. So Cyata is an insurtech where what we really do is we offer a marketplace for wholesale brokers to find, quote, and place SMB insurance, specifically right now in cyber, but we're moving into other product lines as well. So you can imagine a place where, you know, just like us as consumers, you can go and get multiple quotes in one place. That is actually a pretty revolutionary idea in insurance, very revolutionary in specialty insurance. And we've kind of got the secret sauce, a lot of back-end plumbing and support to make it possible for wholesale brokers to do that for kind of the most specialty of specialty policies, which is cyber insurance right now.
Yeah, fantastic. I'm kind of going to go off piece straight away here, which is probably not fair, but I'm going to. But I think the specialty piece is really interesting. And one thing that I've talked about a few times is that sort of innovation has taken its time to get up the food. Is it that complex nature that's taking so long to kind of sort of hit sort of deeper elements of innovation? Is that what's stopping it? Or do you think it's just... is there something else that's kind of made it a little bit more resistant to innovation than other parts of the insurance industry?
So I think one thing is, you know, especially as you go up the chain to more specialty commercial insurance, I believe most carriers, most markets believe that their products are truly unique and stand, you know, out really differently from the rest of the competition. And I think that might be true, right? There are certain coverages for sure that some markets are better at being able to provide for a broader range of appetites. But at the core, the insurance contract, when you're talking about SMB business, which is businesses with revenues less than $100 million, mm-hmm. It's actually pretty standardized at this point. Mm. You know, across the board, I'd say almost, you're not getting the tailored, you know, very individually built towers of risk that you have for a large commercial insured. And the reality is, you know, there might be some tweaks here and there around the edges, but they're pretty similar. And I think it's a little bit of a pride sometimes to say, you know, I don't want to be compared because I think my product truly is special and different, and I'm going to make it difficult to access, mm-hmm. but then also mm-hmm. difficult to actually, you know, get the premium that I want to achieve in the market. So I think that's a little bit what the hesitancy has been. And then I will say on the back end, it is not easy to standardize something that's never been standardized before. So
yeah,
very simply, for example, right? When we start looking at specialty insurances, different insurance markets might say how we classify a small business varies. We don't use any standard industry mapping. We have our own secret sauce type of mapping. That makes it very difficult, as you can imagine. If you want to get five markets to tell you whether they have appetite and what the pricing might look like, you have to guess as a broker, okay, it's called this over here and that over there, and I'm not sure, and this is just too much time, so I'm just going to ask the underwriter to do it for me over email, make it their job. And that's actually not very efficient, because when you're thinking about smaller premium policies, because again, at the end of the day, the contracts are pretty similar, the underwriters, you know, aren't really getting the most bang for their buck by working on these smaller premium policies. Like, it takes about the same effort to underwrite a $25,000 or $50,000 premium account as a $5,000 premium account. And where would you rather your underwriter spend your time, right? If you're an insurance carrier. And so that's part of the reason I think what we did early on was to say, okay, we're going to make this experience very broker, friendly. Basically, how can we make their lives as easy as possible? Because they know a lot about the coverages. They know the differences between different markets. They know who's a good fit for, you know, a particular type of insured in this type of business. But their job shouldn't be trying to decipher, you know, the specifics of an application form for every single market, for every single piece of business. Like, you know, they should be able to put in information once and receive multiple options, and then use their judgment to say, guide their retail agent or the insurer to say, here's what I think is the best match for you based on the coverages you need and the price point you're looking at. Here's where I'd go. That's where their real value add is, rather than trying to guess, okay, am I a marketing consultant or am I a, you know, a management consultant who does marketing on the side? You know, what's the difference? It doesn't really matter. It can be translated, and that work shouldn't be on the broker. That can be something that a interface like Siata can do for them.
Yeah, sure. There's a lot to unpack there. I think you touched on it right at the start. We're talking about culture, and that's something I've been really conscious of, because, you know, I'm very conscious not to bite the hand that feeds me as someone that supplies the insurance and insurtech industry. But specialty, since I've come into the market, and, you know, I've been in this market for 15 years. I used to work for an insurer, and I've been a headhunter serving the industry for 15 years. But specialty is something that over time, the kind of definition of it being kind of unique and standalone has lost its value to me, and I've thought that for a long time. It's like we have very standardized coverage up to exactly that sort of point that you're talking about, but it's doing it in a way that those businesses don't feel undervalued as well. You know, they feel like they're getting the kind of bespoke service. And as you were talking, I was thinking it was kind of the difference between a sort of fully tailored handmade piece of clothing versus, you know, something that is amended to fit you, and that's probably kind of where we need to go with it. I know there was a big push for the kind of broking community about, it's been a big push for this for a while, but kind of to sort of reframe as kind of risk consultants. And I'm thinking, well, that's what they should be doing, because my only concern with potential, you know, the sort of service that you're offering is it's a bit like the travel insurance world, right? So travel insurance now, you buy it off the shelf, it's very, very cheap. But the argument made by people like Battleface, who we've had on, is actually it's not fit for purpose. It doesn't cover you as much as you need. And I think that's the kind of worry if you go into sort of standardization, is that actually people are, it's unqualified people like myself buying insurance for their business, thinking because it looks like it should cover you, and then knowing it doesn't. And that's why there's kind of still a role for the broker within that. Is that what you're pushing towards? So, because it's certainly no part of your messaging that you're trying to replace the broker. This is very much a kind of tool to kind of help them, would you say, almost enhance the service? Is that the way you view it?
That's exactly right, Alex. I think one way we are unique compared to other insurtechs that, you know, have also tried to develop marketplaces is many of them try to really disintermediate, right? First, go direct to the insured and small business. And in the US market, which is a very different from the European and British markets, and I've worked across both in my time as a management consultant, American small business owners do not want to go and find their own insurance. It's just not going to happen. It's not even happening in personal lines nearly as quickly as it's happened in other parts of the world. And so for their business, it's the last thing they're going to do. They're going to call their trusty agent, you know, probably when they're small, they'll call their personal lines agent who may or may not know too much about small business, especially specialty risks. And that agent will call their wholesale broker who does know a ton about these specialty risks. And then in the US, you know, we have really expert brokers almost. So not just wholesale, but we, you know, one of the brokers we work with does 98% of his business only in cyber, right? Because he is the go-to guy in the New England area for cyber. And that's kind of, you know, that we can have that level of specialization because we have so many businesses and the market's changing constantly. So that is one thing I'll say about specialty, right? Even if it is a standardized product, we've seen in the last 6 months since I've joined Sayada alone, a huge change in terms of, you know, rates, obviously it's a hardening market, but also the controls that insurers want to see in place. And that means that a small business that easily could have gotten a policy in place 2 years ago to meet a contractual requirement without multi-factor authentication today and endpoint detection and, you know, this and that, they're not going to be able to actually renew that policy. And they may not even know what those terms are, what that means, what the easiest, and the reality is it's actually pretty easy to implement some of these things. You know, if you're using Gmail, for instance, as for your email service, you can just turn it on via Gmail. There's really easy ways to kind of put these controls in place. And that's where I think the risk consultant side of a broker, of a their relationship with their retail agent, where they're kind of sharing, hey, this is going to be required from now on. You should probably warn all of your clients that as they come up for renewal, this is going to be a new, you know, must have. And you obviously don't want to kind of let your liability policy lapse because risks are becoming more and more, you know, apparent to everyone. That's the kind of, I think, relationship and the value add service that, you know, is very hard to replace in terms of the current small business, you know, insurance market. And that's why Sayada's goal is to say, you know, that's where your value add is. That's where you should be spending your time. It's talking to clients, talking to insurers, helping actually, you know, make the changes that make them better protected, not, you know, searching for quotes, not trying to get your binder out the door. Like, let us help you with those things, because that is a, those are very standardized processes and we can do that very efficiently for you. What we can't do for you is speak to the, you know, client and say, advise them the way that you would and the way you have experience, because you've seen claims, you know, for decades potentially, and you know what to watch out for. You know where the, okay, you're going to go with the cheaper policy here, but this is the coverage that's excluded. Let me tell you what that means and what that could look like if, you know, God forbid the worst happened. That's something that only really a broker and agent with the relationship with the insured can actually effectively share that message about. And so that's why we and part of why I was so excited to join Sayada was that after having spent, you know, I spent about 10 years at McKinsey and Company advising, you know, globally multinational insurers and brokers of all shapes and sizes in the US, in Europe, in the UK. And I think from my experience and understanding, it was so clear to me that the broker's role is still quite important and it's not going away anytime soon. Sure. And Sayada really said, okay, let's take a look at the reality of the current marketplace and the market dynamics and figure out how we can actually like add value and improve without trying to disrupt something that it's not there yet. That's not where we are in 2022. You know, brokers and agents have a very important role to play. And business owners, their jobs, even their, you know, even if they're like a decent size, we're talking 20 million in revenue, insurance is not what they think about when they wake up in the morning. They think about running their business. And they rely on experts to really support them. And so how can we help those experts and help them in a way where we're not kind of making it expensive and, you know, becoming another hurdle in the process, but being a real support to them and saying, we got you, we'll take care of all of your smaller policies. You spend your time on the things that you do best, which is advising the clients and tailoring those larger, more complex pieces of business that, you know, maybe there's been claims, maybe it's a really large account, maybe there's multiple lines to place and, you know, there's real complexity about how it gets placed. That's where you should be spending your time because it's really worthwhile and no one else can do that right now.
I could swap in insurance broker for headhunter and recruitment professional, to be honest. So I've got to agree with that by default. But there's a lot of echoes of that because it's an intermediary role, right? And you know, it's really funny because every time there's an evolution in recruiting technology, I get told my job's going to be replaced. And you know, I had to write an article this morning actually for my marketing team, and you know, it's about the use of executive search. It was like, yes, you can do all of these things yourself, but it is a function of your business. So for example, with these clients, unless they're big enough to have their own independent insurance mm-hmm. department that is an expert and can go and do all this for them, you have to kind of work with intermediaries because they're the expert advisors. And I've told this story probably too many times on the podcast, but when I went to renew my insurance and they were going, how much professional indemnity cover do you need? I have absolutely no idea. I've never made no one's ever claimed against me. I don't even know the circumstances in which they could, you know, I wouldn't know. So if the average claim size is 100,000, they'll probably want 100,000. But unless I have that information, I wouldn't know. So, you know, I think it's crucial. And then, you know, we're not talking about very small businesses. We're actually talking about significant businesses, you know, that have significant risk exposure and complex risk exposure. And one of my things about the kind of broker's role is that they know risks about that business isn't even aware that they have, and not even just a business as that's evolving. Cyber has kind of added something. So, you know, the cyber coverage I have now is far beyond anything I've ever required to have before. But just kind of knowing that business intimately and kind of looking after them, it's that trusted advisor role. I just don't see it going away. I don't actually really see a future in which it does ever go away, because mm-hmm. I think it's about preference. And you know, if it was going to go that route, no one would ever visit a clothes shop ever again. But we know we want to go and visit clothes shops, you know, like we because we want to look and touch and feel, and it's a slightly different kind of rationale. But I think there's a security, and when you're buying something which is about protection against risk, part of that is kind of, for me, is that relationship with my insurer or my broker, and feeling, you know, the way I feel about it from an emotional standpoint. And mm-hmm. and we don't talk about feelings in business very often, but you're still kind of still how humans operate. So it's, you know, absolutely. Still, yeah, it's like I said this thing on voting, and apparently people don't vote with any kind of rationale. You know, you sort of make a gut decision, and then you
can definitely see that right now.
yeah right. And it's not open that can of worms, but the evidence for psychologically, you rationalize it afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the emotion part of it is very important. So
yeah. And one of the most emotional parts of the journey, right, which we don't think about because we don't usually run into it, but in the life of a small business, you know, it's going to happen at some point, is when a claim happens mm-hmm. and it feels like you versus the insurer potentially, you yeah. know, do you really want to be there alone? Yeah. Or do you wish you had, you know, had purchased it through your agent, call your agent? And I mean, I think good agents will still pick up the phone call anyway. And help guide you through what you should expect, what the process looks like, what the timelines look like, what, you know, what kind of, you know, detailing of records and information they should be prepared to provide, you know, who is going to be that person in your arena, right, when it comes down to it. That is, I think, also a big role that brokers and agents play. And they know what a fair outcome looks like. They know what a, you know, maybe a slightly less, you know, protected small business might get versus one that has, like, you know, defenses. And so those are all things that I think that we don't love to think about, but on the flip side of why we're buying the insurance, right? It's incredibly helpful to have a supportive agent to help walk you through what happens in the worst case scenarios. And that's, again, something that right now no one can really replace, that human touch. There are, of course, plenty of services offering, you know, cybersecurity protection and, you know, monitoring, et cetera. But it isn't a human you've probably ever met face to face or talked to on the phone multiple times a year. You know, you don't have the same relationship. And so the trust level is absolutely different. I do agree with you there.
Mm. So I wanted to talk about your decision to join Cyata. So you joined in January, is that right?
January, yep.
Yeah. And that was following the latest funding round.
Yeah.
I wanted to just understand, like, you know, that clearly there would have been other job opportunities. Why specifically was this interesting to you? And I kind of, I suppose, reflecting on the stage they're at as well, not just the kind of specific dynamic of the, you know, the product or service.
So two things. One is I hadn't actually meant to be a lifelong consultant. Just, you know, as things happen, you just happen to be enjoying your work and you keep going. And one day you wake up and you've been there 10 years. That wasn't never the, really the plan. The flip side is I could say like insurance was never really the plan either, but I felt like during my time at McKinsey, I was lucky enough to serve clients, you know, including specialty carriers, including a lot of work in London, in the London market. And one of the big refrains I'd heard about was, you know, we need an easier way to access the good SMB business from the US. And London is an incredible place with a lot of fantastic risk-bearing appetite and really creative, I think, thinking around insurance contracts. And I've always have had a soft spot for the carrier side of the market, because I think the last 20 years has been a story of generally brokers and agents kind of returning or earning more of the economic profits in the insurance industry, and carriers kind of being quite squeezed. Now you can say that, you know, they needed to innovate faster, they needed to move faster, but, you know, at the same time, fundamentally, none of us would be in the space if there weren't underwriters willing to, you know, kind of develop these very complex legal contracts. And that's why commerce exists, right? At the very core of it all is like, none of us would be in business if we were really personally liable for all of the things that might go wrong. So I have a huge amount of respect for carriers and underwriters. And I did believe that like the current way is, you know, you walk around London and you see folks holding binders of paper, you know, this is a couple of years ago, but like, it was mind boggling. and of course, you know, like, big complex things, sure, you probably need reams of paper, but for the more simple, you know, relatively standard sized risks coming out of the US, you know, it didn't make sense. And so Cyata also had seen that opportunity around the same time, and their story was just kind of phenomenal. So, you know, within a year and a half, like, they had gone from just putting out the platform in January 2020 to having, you know, hundreds of regular users, to, you know, doubling premium every quarter. You know, it was just like, clearly product market fit was there, you know, and that's obviously why the fundraising round became as big as it did, which is also why they could afford me, because I, you know, as much as I like loved watching the business from the size and hearing about the phenomenal growth, obviously I also, you know, needed to get paid a decent income. So when they called right after that round was completed, I was very excited. I was like, this is a stage where you're still really one relatively an early exec. You can shape a lot of the business. No one was really in charge of and taking care of the carrier relationships and the market partnerships. There was a huge amount of kind of potential there, both from improving things from on the day-to-day front with our market partners who are already on the platform, to thinking about who are the most strategic new partners to bring on board, to thinking about where do we go next, right? What there's a lot of, you know, future potential still on the table and not fully shaped. You know, there's ideas, but not shaped, informed, and executed. So that chance to get in early and actually be like, have a voice at the table and to really help guide what I thought was already a pretty promising young business was irresistible. So they made an offer and I couldn't refuse. The team is also just, I think, it's a little, I will say I was a little wary, you know. I knew the CEO reasonably well, but I didn't know the other co-founders. They all live in Israel, and our R&D and product teams sit in Israel. And I'd never really actually worked with an Israeli company as a client or anything like that. But of course, I'd heard about the very direct way of doing business, and, you know, the style is quite different. I'm a pretty direct person. You might be getting that in this interview. So that actually turned out to be a great fit. But still, you know, it's like fully remote. You're not going to spend a lot of time together. Is this going to work out? And I think, you know, what I really respected during the interview process with them was that they wanted to both know my ideas, and then they are very open to challenging me and each other. And then the goal is to find out what is the real, like, data-driven truth, right? And not in a kind of creepy, like, you know, Ray Dalio principles, like, I have to tell you, I hate you, you know, none of that, but more in the very true, like, okay, that seems like an interesting assumption. what's our evidence? Where can we go gather that? And I love that approach to thinking about problems and saying, okay, if we can't find enough evidence to go with this hunch or gut, you know, like we're not going to do it, right? But on the flip side, we need to go look actively look for evidence to disprove whatever theory we have before we make that big strategic new big next step. And so that I think really fit well with my with my kind of background. I, you know, working at McKinsey for so long, always being data driven, and with I think some of what I felt like was the hesitation I saw from the carriers that I'd worked with is, at the end of the day, you have to make a decision. You need to decide: are you plunging into this market? Are you plunging into this new product line? Into this new digital business, whatever it is that you're thinking about building? And sometimes you get really stuck in, I don't know, I'm not sure, we think this, we think that, but, you know, and the data may not be perfectly available, perfectly clear, but you need to do your best job possible to gather it. And then I think you need to move forward. And I got the sense that this company, like, you know, the leadership really was very much on board with that. And, you know, what they had built so far was kind of evidence. So that's the long-winded way of saying how I ended up at Siyata, and it's been a remarkable ride since.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm always interested to ask that question because it's, you know, obviously my role is usually pulling people from either the insurance industry, management consultancy is quite common, and putting them into insurtechs because that's our business model. So we're always kind of interested to say, you know, why and why specifically? Because I talk a lot about being like, actually, one of my advice to founders is being like brutally honest about where you're at in your journey, you know, what your runway is, you know, what's the North Star, what we're aiming for, where do we have gaps? Because people will forgive you for gaps because you're in a startup mode. There's always going to be challenges. They won't forgive you if you don't tell them what they are and you're not honest about them. Because if you kind of discover them when you get there, that's one, obviously it's disingenuous and that's a sort of bad culture. But secondly, it's people don't like surprises in that context. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll forgive you if you've told them, but they won't forgive you otherwise. So the brutal honesty, and I think the culture of that, I think is hugely positive. I think we had Kevin Mackey in from Coterie, and he was talking about having a culture of, he definitely used a better term than this, but it was like essentially healthy conflict. It was like everything should be available to be questioned. It doesn't matter whose decision it is. And I think it's hugely important, but it's like, right, we think that. Let's see what the evidence says. That seems a really healthy way to work. I want to talk to you about McKinsey, and you know, you were there for 10 years. You huge amount of kind of respect. It's a cachet name to have on the resume. What do you think that's, what have you brought with you from there that you think kind of specifically adds value in your team in this sort of insurtech startup type environment? Is there sort of a couple of things that you go, that it's great that I've brought that with me, that sort of toolkit?
So the toolkit is absolutely, you know, just the idea of like, let's disaggregate this problem into a timeline and of steps of ways to actually kind of find evidence, mm-hmm. develop hypothesis, test mm-hmm. it and go, right? I mean, that I think absolutely. I think even more than that, I think what I didn't appreciate until I left is you get a lot of reps of seeing a lot of different ways of running things and of doing things inside of a given industry. And so, you know, from really healthy companies thinking about growth and expansion and building new to ones that are almost at the end of their runway, right? And kind of really distress mode. And you see kind of the differences in culture. You see the differences in the types of talent that have been hired and promoted. You see the differences in management styles. And so you see a lot of the differences between kind of what worked really well and what didn't work out, right? And so I think having the number of reps when you're joining a smaller company that, you know, our founders, like they've been working on this for 5 years. This has been their baby. And while they've like gone through a huge number of growth spurts inside of the company itself, right? Getting it to this type of business model, you know, scaling it to where we are today, they haven't seen how others do it, if that makes sense, right? And this is, I think, part of why, if you think about serial founders in the US are extremely popular, you know, they get incredible rounds of funding. Adam Newman being an example. Yeah.
I was just very, thinking very that, like, right, even if they've made a complete disaster of it, yeah.
There is one argument for it, which is to say that if a founder's job is raising enough money, he got an A++.
yeah. I did see someone write the counter argument to say that, you know, we now have these kind of WeWork spaces which just weren't a thing, and now they are a thing. So it's clearly like the idea was right, the execution was amiss is the thing. But that's a whole podcast, but there's a reason though, right?
I think it's that the stress of founding and actually get, even if you fail eventually, getting it to any like sizable type of business, that's pretty impressive. And then that person knows what mistakes they made last time, and they're more likely to succeed. I mean, I love this, but I you know, fact that I think Bloomberg started Bloomberg at 38, you know, or like maybe even later than that, much, much later than we think of, right? Typically. Mm. And it's because he saw a lot first, that he saw a huge market opportunity and you know, kind of capitalized in it with the terminals. And so I think similarly, like a management consultant who's been around for a while, so I'm saying more than like the 2-year normal stint that folks have done, you really get to know the management inside of so many different companies and see what's healthy and what's unhealthy in every company. Every company has both sides, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you can kind of like remember those lessons and start actually immediately trying to put them in place, put in action what needs to be changed in your new company, especially as a new person, you have a bit of leeway in your first 6 months, right? A year, to say, hey, these are all the other ways we could be doing this. So like, can we explore this? And here's an example of a story from where I saw this being successful. Here's another example. Here's another. And your network also similarly has like a huge number of examples to draw upon. And so I think that is something that I found has been very, very helpful, is to say, okay, when we're talking about, you know, next product line and how we strategize around that, lots of different ways of like looking at the problem, and also lots of different ways of actually getting to a decision and moving forward with a decision. And that I think is just as valuable as the toolkit piece, which is a little bit more, you can get that within 2 years, you're kind of good to go. But you don't necessarily know what are the signs that, I'm sensing that something's a little off here, or we need to make a management correction over here, or we need to change the way we, you know, discuss really important topics and drive to a conclusion and decision over here. We need to think about how we speak in front of the board and what, you know, is important for them to hear, and where we need advice. All of those things, I think, has been really valuable lessons that I've been really, it's been exciting to kind of, it felt like I was like, you know, getting ready for the real game for so many years. And now to kind of go and flex my muscles out in the real world, it's been really exciting.
I must say, I field calls from management consultants about all week. And it's always, I'm fed up of giving advice on the sideline, and I want to get involved and put and play on the pitch. And I do understand that. But I think it's exactly, as you were talking, I thought it's really interesting, management consultancy as a career. It's something I'd always, if I knew about it, I didn't really know about it, and my career had already sort of up and running by then, I always thought it would have been quite interesting to do. And in fact, headhunting came out of management consultancy, I think. But the thing is, it's that exposure. It's the equivalent of having like 20 different jobs, you know, because you've been on all these different projects, and exactly that's the good and the bad. And, you know, I talk about, sometimes clients are, it's hard to, on my client base, go, how do you know what a good candidate looks like? And I went, because I've met so many, I've seen so many bad ones, and actually it's not even bad, you've just seen it's a bell-shaped curve. Most talent is in the middle of that section. Yeah, it's very few very, very bad ones, it's just very few exceptional ones, and it's almost like you know what they look like. And then it's funny when we get new people in the team, and you can even tell by the way someone is communicating, like whether they're going to take an offer or not. Literally it's the cadence, it's the choice of the language, it's the choice of the method of communication. You sit in the corner and you don't want your team to get demoralized, but you're sitting there going, well, that's never happening. Yeah. that's not going on the forecast.
Pattern recognition.
It's just pattern recognition. So I think that's the reps are great. Asking you about this sort of management consultancy piece again, you know, we talk about innovation on the podcast a lot. Obviously carriers are trying to innovate, the whole industry is trying to innovate, brokers are trying to innovate. Some of the ways that they do that is bringing your management consultancy in to look at that. You know, now you're a neutral, you've had that experience, you're fond of it, we can tell. do you think that's a good approach? Or and that might be cut too simple. Are there weaknesses in it? And what do you think they are?
And I will be brutally honest, as I generally tend to be, which is
I'm getting that.
You know, so I think it makes a lot of sense up to a point, right? Yeah. Because so what's really interesting is how quickly you lose touch with what the rest of the market is doing when you're inside and running a business and dealing with the day-to-day and the, you know, the operations and trying to improve this bit or that bit or whatever. You may lose touch very quickly with what is happening externally, except for the headlines.
Yeah.
And by the time you're seeing it in a headline in the insurance journal, you're way behind, right? Yeah. All of your competitors are seeing it at the same time, right? So that's not keeping up with the market, I'd say, right? And we have a lot of insurance journals, so that isn't, you know, you can subscribe to all of them and still actually not be thinking the four or five steps ahead you need to be in order to make sure that you're at the forefront. And so that's where I do think like an external consultant coming in and saying, let me scan the market for you. Let me go and find out what is new and interesting and is getting a lot of attention for good reasons and what seems to be kind of overhyped and not important to spend your energy thinking about. And let me frame out some choices you have in a strategic path forward, right? Here's one direction you could go if you believe XYZ. Here's another direction you can go if you believe ABC. At the end of the day, the management team have to decide though. And that's where I think the consultants, you can, it really depends on the strength of the relationship you have in terms of trust with that consultant, how much you believe that they really know what they're talking about. And this is where, you know, the last 20 years in management consultancy has been more and more specialization, which is back when I joined, you weren't necessarily required to become an insurance expert. And by the time I left, it wasn't good enough to just be an insurance expert. You needed to be an insurance digital business expert or an insurance claims automation expert. Like you really needed to know your stuff in very specific areas. And that I think, you know, kind of can help the management team decide, okay, is this consultant someone that really knows what they're talking about, has a current pulse on the latest in whatever area we need to make a decision about? Or is it a little bit high level and too generic in terms of what they're suggesting? But at the end of the day, the decision-making falls with the management team, how they make that decision, how they go and communicate that decision to the company, to the teams that are relevant, how they kind of incentivize everybody to go after and execute that decision. And then how they follow up in terms of supportive accountability, which I think is something that is scary. That's the reason a lot of decisions don't seem to really get done or get half done is my job on the line if I took a risk that didn't pan out? And the reality is, you know, most companies I'd say that I saw probably not. It may be that accumulated several decisions that didn't pan out, but not like for any particular one. But in order to, for a, you know, really talented person inside of a larger company to feel, you know, comfortable and excited about going and taking that risk and say, I need this budget. I'm going to go and build this thing. And let's talk again in 9 months and see if I have made enough progress. And I feel like there's enough, you know, momentum here that I want more budget to scale it. In order to do that, you need to have bosses that are actually really comfortable with saying, sure, yeah, I trust you and I'm willing to support you. And then we'll have the conversation in 9 months. But if the answer is no, we're going to pull the plug. It's not going to be about you. It's going to be about, you know, lessons learned from this journey and about how we apply that to the next project we want you to work on. Right. And I think that isn't necessarily very well communicated today by most kind of big companies. So at the end of the day, you know, you might explore what are the innovative new things you should be doing as a company with the support of consultants, but then going after that and giving enough support for the most talented people in your company to be the ones executing, that is the part I think the management still need to figure out, and it's very much on them. So they can support you to an extent, but at the end of the day, you're the one who has to be the leader that says, okay, you know what? I want you to take this risk. I'm going to give you this kind of leeway, this kind of support, here's the budget, here's the resource, let's do this cadence of check-ins on it. And then if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But I'd rather we took the risk and we put our best talent on this than we kind of hemmed and hawed, and maybe we signed one or two people, but not really enough to get anything done. and then nothing came out of it. And 2 years later, we're looking around going, oh man, our competitors have really pulled ahead, right? That's like the, I think the more unfortunately common story of innovation versus the, okay, we made a real bet and we're going to go after this. And we figured out a way to actually get our most promising talent to work on this project.
Yeah, there's so much important stuff in there. I think about, you know, this terror, I don't like the phrase, but I'm going to use it anyway, the intrapreneur. I like what it represents. I'm not sold on the phrase. I think it's because I'm so defensive of the fact that I'm an entrepreneur and I'm like, yeah, it's all on the line for me. And so when someone goes intrapreneur, I'm like, meh. But culturally, I think it's really important. And really what you're actually saying is you need to be prepared to fail. Innovation is about being, for me, it's about being prepared to fail. You need to try things and, you know, as we were talking earlier, make a hypothesis, test it with the data available to you, but it can still be wrong. You can still go off in a direction and be wrong. But you need to be allowed to, for that to be okay. So I think the companies that seem to do it well, one, you have to have this C-suite level support that kind of really, really gets behind it. You need to put enough resources to it, because there's so many people out there, oh, what's our innovation division? Oh, it's you know, it's Sarah and Dave in that dark cupboard in the corner, and they're driving innovation for this enormous carrier, for example. Thankfully, I think those days are a little bit behind us. But then even more than that, I think it's enabling the business, you know, the culture of like Silicon Valley businesses where you're like 4 days a week you work on your work, and then one day where you're experimenting, playing. We haven't implemented that in insurance. And part of me goes, well, why not? You know, like, well, maybe we should. But, you know, it may not be as simple as defined as that, but kind of allowing ideas to happen. And I always think about the matchbox when I talk about that. The matchbox is always used to have two strike plates. Mm-hmm. And then someone said, you know, we need to make more money. And they said, well, why don't we just have one strike plate? And they're like, oh. I don't know if this is true, but this is the old wives tale I'm told is that that just came from the factory floor. Someone just said, why don't we just have one? And then you're like, right, 50% saving, thanks very much. You know, and it's that's innovation at its heart. So just then allowing that to happen and encouraging that is very difficult, and using kind of a consultancy to kind of kickstart that kind of makes perfect sense. I'm really conscious of time. I'm just enjoying our conversation, which is always tricky, but this is a really key question for me that I wanted to talk about, which is, you know, talent is my thing. That's what I'm focused on. You know, you're someone that's come out of a really good career at McKinsey, a great business, and then have joined the insurtech industry. You know, what do you think we can do to continue to encourage that attraction of talent from, and I know you were touching on the insurance industry, so it's kind of like, you know, maybe it's an easier capture than others, but what do you think we can do to kind of better promote insurtech specifically as a place to for talented people to come and work?
I mean, honestly, I think it's doing well compared to a couple of years ago.
Definitely.
If I talk to my business school classmates, like you know, years ago, nobody wanted to go into insurtech. Right. There were so many other exciting opportunities. And I think it's catching on because now there are so many different options. They seem like exciting careers. I think there is intimidation, though, about the level of knowledge of insurance you need to have. To be honest, it is one of the few, I think, industries where it does feel like it's an expert's field. Right. And there's a lot of, you know, respect for folks who have 30 years of knowledge and, you know, did the usual underwriter or broker and like work their way up kind of to the top. And I think there needs to be a way to kind of more quickly get folks up to speed in whatever line of business that they're thinking about helping innovate. I don't think there's any shortcuts really right now in the insurance industry. And I think that's something that, you know, I would imagine something like a Lloyd's could probably really help with is what is our short, you know, continuing ed course for new executives or, you know, insurtech leaders who came from other industries, because we need them more than ever to help actually innovate insurance. So can we figure out a way to give them the the mini boot camp, right? McKinsey actually did a phenomenal job at this for folks who decided to specialize in insurance. We had a little getaway for a couple of days, an offsite where you got trained properly on, you know, what a insurance carrier's balance sheet looked like, and you know what a portfolio management looked like, et cetera. Nothing like what a someone who had grown up in an insurance company might have seen, but still very helpful in helping you kind of learn the language and get into the meat of the business. So I think that's one thing. I think there is definitely also the fact that it isn't a particularly diverse environment. And I think, you know, there are definitely lots of folks working on this and caring a lot about it. But at the same time, when going back to pattern recognition, this is a little bit the downside, is it's just so easy to kind of stick with the familiar, continue recruiting from the same places that you know about. And especially right now, the market for diverse talent is, like, you know, really hot. So why should they come to you over another place? And I'll say, like, when I was thinking about joining Siata, for me, it was very important that there were other women, there were other folks of color in the organization already. I wasn't going to be number one at all. I might be the most kind of, you know, senior one. But it, at the same time, I was absolutely not alone. And I knew from the beginning that that meant that they put their money where their mouth is, right? They were actually going out and seeking diverse talent. They'd hired it into all levels of the organization. And now they wanted to kind of bolster their executive team as well. And so it wasn't just a lot of workshops and seminars and, you know, lots of broadcasting about how much it mattered, but it was actually, hey, let's show me your roster of people and tell me what kind of diverse backgrounds they came from, including whether they're from insurance or not, right? And I think that is something where it takes a lot more effort, right? You spend more time in recruiting, especially, and saying, telling your headhunters that you want a diverse slate and you're not going to move forward on making a decision until you've seen multiple other options. And I think it's really important to be supportive as a workplace, which I think for me is comes in a lot of forms. But the fact that we take care of each other as employees, we check in on each other, we celebrate each other's, like, personal and professional triumphs, I think those kind of things mean a lot. It's part of culture that's almost intangible, and especially today in the remote world, can be easy to forget and make it a very, you know, let's clock in and clock out at the end of the day, right? And that's not the kind of life, I think, that most young, talented folks coming from other parts of business want, right? They want a place that is supportive, maybe not their entire lives, but it is a place where, you know, their life is celebrated and they can feel, you know, they can be personal and share things that are happening about their lives, and they can form friendships and they can get training and be vulnerable. And it's not going to be seen negatively, like they have to just fit in and speak the way everyone else speaks and not kind of show their true selves. I think that's it's harder to describe the specific activities you need to do as a team to kind of encourage all of that. I think for me, what I believe really strongly from my kind of decade of consulting is that role modeling makes a huge difference, right? If you're a CEO or C-suite, never talk about themselves. Never talk about their families, never talk about what they do outside of work, never show up for the happy hours or for the celebrations, you know, aren't congratulating someone when they have a baby or get married or, you know, whatever. It kind of sends a message, right? That's not what's important. Yeah. And if people treat life like it's not as important as work, you're not going to inspire the people who want to have a healthy, you know, balance of both. And I think that's something that comes through when you're recruiting by talking to the team members who work for them. So that's my belief is, like, so I love basically when I'm recruiting, and I'm recruiting right now, when I talk to candidates to actually understand, okay, tell me about yourself, you know, whatever you feel comfortable sharing. It doesn't need to be everything, but what do you care about? What are your professional aspirations in the next couple of years? And do I think Siata could be a good fit for them? And also what are your personal ones, right? What are you looking for in your life? If you really want to be in person, for instance, and celebrating constantly with coworkers every Friday, like, that's not this job because it's mostly remote for our US colleagues. But if you like gathering in some beautiful city that the insurance industry has decided is perfect for a conference once a quarter, and you love, you know, kind of, you know, making the most of those interactions kind of while we're together, but then being able to have a lot of freedom at home when we're not, then this is perfect, right? Like that's I think the kind of thing that you actually also need to probe for, because it's not just about the content and the position and the title. It's also about like, what kind of life does a job enable you to live?
Yeah, I think there's, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I could probably say yes, quite a lot. But yeah, I so much of that. And that's changed in my thinking. I mean, I used to work in that environment where it was respect the hierarchy, wear the right suits, say the right things, be interested in the same things. But I'm so much happier in my working environment, in just like, I've just been more myself, and you know, I'm not wearing a suit now. And because I don't normally wear suits, and it's not really that important at all. But and just I've talked about myself more than they've ever done, and I know if you've got a podcast, and you know, we're a bit more open on things like LinkedIn, but I think it's important because it humanizes people, because we're still talking, take it right back to start this conversation, the reason you do business with your broker is probably because you probably quite like that person, and yeah, you trust that person, but you trust them because you probably know something about them as well. If all I knew about you is that you're the chief commercial officer of Siata, that's not enough for there to be a sort of a sort of connection, because over time those relationships develop, because we get to know you and what you like and what you don't like, and what will what someone's gonna be happy or sad about. And I think that's kind of so important, but particularly when we're talking about sort of a diversity hiring, it is about openness, because how can someone be, if someone's unapproachable, then that just exacerbates the problem. And I've got to share this with you, and I'm really conscious of time, and we need to go, but I was sent because we've launched this thing called We Are InsurTech Women, which my colleague Sophie is running, as a networking opportunity for women in InsurTech to kind of to build those networks. So they get more opportunities. Obviously I couldn't run it, so Sophie's running it, because it sends the wrong message if I go, oh, I'm running this. So it's Sophie's project to run with. But because of that, we get sent invites. So we got sent an invite, and it was tackling diversity hiring and insurance. We're like, well, this is good. And it's a panel of four guys and one woman. And they're all white guys, and they're all middle-aged. and one of the talking points is meritocracy versus diversity, I think. And I was like, oh, we can see the tone of the conversations going.
No.
So you just go, oh wow. But I think there's more people that think as with the conversation we just had than don't. But it's fascinating, and it shows you what a mountain we've got to climb. Thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast. I've really enjoyed this. I knew I was going to. So I really, really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to be with us on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me, Alex. This was a really great time. Thank you.
Thank you. As always, this podcast is brought to you by FinPro Search Partners, often simply known as FinPro. FinPro is an executive recruitment business working in the insurance and insurtech space on an international basis. If you would like to find out more about FinPro, please visit our website, www.wearefinpro.com, or our FinPro company page on LinkedIn. I've been your host, Alex Bond, and I would personally love to connect with anyone who is interested in the changing world of insurance. So feel free to reach out to me directly, either on LinkedIn or via my email of alex@wearefinpro.com. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and I hope to see you back next week. Thank you. As always, this podcast is brought to you by FinPro Search Partners, often simply known as FinPro. FinPro is an executive recruitment business working in the insurance and insurtech space on an international basis. If you would like to find out more about FinPro, please visit our website, www.wearefinpro.com, or our FinPro company page on LinkedIn. I've been your host, Alex Bond, and I would personally love to connect with anyone who is interested in the changing world of insurance. So feel free to reach out to me directly, either on LinkedIn or via my email of alex@wearefinpro.com. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and I hope to see you back next week. Thank you.